Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Radio Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Total Tutor, and Pinterest, Neil Haley. And I remember Paige when she was at the Civic Light Opera in 2005 in The Sound of Music, where she was such a fantastic performer. A lot of you have remembered her from Trading Spaces, but now she's an Emmy Award nominee in 2013 for OWN's network, Homemade Simple. So I want to welcome the program, Paige Davis. Paige, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
You are definitely the jack of all trades, Paige. Think about it, all the different things that you do in this business, in the entertainment field, don't you?
It's true. I sometimes feel a little spastic because I'm never sure what to put my energy toward at any given time, because I love the hosting and I've done a lot of stage work and musical work and wrote a book, you know, thought about writing some more. Right now, I've been putting a lot of my energy toward writing a blog. I never really thought I'd find myself in that space, but I've been dedicating a lot of time to my social media platforms and reaching out and connecting in that way. And one of the best ways to do that is to blog. So I've been writing quite a bit again. I hadn't really written a whole lot since I wrote my book. So it's been fun to tap into all of that.
So what types of stuff are you writing on your blog for our listeners out there so they can check it out and check it out?
Well, they would check it out by going to pagedavis.com, which is pretty easy. And the blog is called Positively Paige, and it essentially, you know, it's a bit of a double entendre. I might be using that phrase incorrectly, but it's positive because people do know me as a positive person, but it's also positively me. It's all of me. So I don't really hold back. You know, I say it's untarnished, unvarnished, and I don't even remember my own tagline. you know, I'm just really honest about it. So things that come up or things that I think about, I write about. I've written about everything from my husband to what it feels like to be a girl to, you know, Monica Lewinsky and the Vanity Fair article to what it's like to be an aging dancer. So many different things, you know, whatever's on your mind, training my new little puppy, jealousy of the 20-year-old girl that lives across the hall, and, you know, just kind of life things and things that come up.
The real person, you know, the real Paige, so that we get to
the
know
real her. Me.
the one that you wrote the book about, not the one that you sometimes might see on stage that, hey, you're playing somebody else. And then when you're on TV, we all know what television does. Television kind of
right.
presents a different Paige Davis, the Paige Davis that they
yes,
want to
the real Paige.
Exactly.
That's the tagline, unvarnished, untarnished, and real.
Now, Paige, talking about your career and specifically for our audience, did you break in through the theater or did you break in through TV?
Oh, definitely theater. My whole background was musical theater. I majored in dance at a performing arts high school in Louisville, Kentucky, and I majored in dance at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. And my trajectory was very normal, I think. You know, I studied dance, and then I did summer stock. You know, when I was in college, I did summer stock and, you know, did musical theater, and then moved on to doing a couple regional things, and then booked a national tour of a Broadway show, and then eventually booked a Broadway show, and then just kind of, like, worked my way up. I kind of climbed the ladder. And the television thing came a little bit later. You know, I think I was already in my 30s when I booked Trading Spaces, and it was the first, other than maybe a couple of commercials, it was the first television I had ever done. And, you know, at that time, it was a very new form of television, this sort of realm of reality.
Right.
It was great. You know, I just really was myself, and found out very quickly that as much as I love dancing and love musical theater, I really, really loved the hosting world too. And I kind of got off on telling the story through that medium and talking to the producers and knowing how it was going to be edited and all of that stuff kind of really turned me on. So because that opportunity turned out to be the kind of the success that it did, Trading Spaces really, really took off. And so many people, you know, still remember it and love it. It opened a lot of doors for me. So I started to pursue more avenues in the television realm. But all the while, I kept going back to theater, primarily Chicago. You know, I had been in the musical Chicago on tour, did the international production in Portugal, was on Broadway with the company long before Trading Spaces, and then continued to go back in, which was great. I, you know, if I ever had an opportunity to go back in, I did. And I filled in every now and again when they needed somebody, which has been wonderful for me. I guess it was last year. Well, maybe it was 2 years ago. I filled in on Broadway for a couple of months. And it's incredible to return to the role after having been away actually for a long time and also having had the role live inside me for, you know, 10 years at this point, how much I'd grown in the role and believe I would continue to just grow and grow and grow and grow. Every time I do it, I think, oh gosh, how did I not know that? You know, how did I not see that? But you also become a different person as you age and you can bring so much more to it. So it's not even just that your craft has improved. It's also you have changed. So that experience has been wonderful, and I love going back to the theater. And I'm going to do a play this summer.
Oh, great. What play are you doing this summer?
It's a play called Dancing Lessons. It's a world premiere of a new play, and it's being premiered at Barrington Stage, which is a wonderful place to work. They transfer a lot of things to New York, and a lot of my friends and New York talent have worked up there. It's in the Berkshires.
Okay.
And so I should have a lovely summer out of the heat of New York City.
Absolutely. Let's think about this. What's really interesting, Paige, is by Trading Spaces opened up the door for you to be a really big headliner, I think, in a lot of ways, and a draw, because people loved you in Trading Spaces. So a lot of people are attracted to, when you were in the Sound of Music, different things. Hey, I want to see the headliner, Paige Davis.
Oh, of course. I'm certain that's why I had the opportunity to audition for the Sound of Music in the way that I did. You know, it was sort of mine to lose. I was told, like, you have to come in. We have to make sure you can do this, but we want you to do it. You know, that the opportunity that Trading Spaces afforded me is something that, I mean, you can't even really quantify it. Even now, as my fame skillet has cooled, it still has with it a recognizability, like, what it offered me is the chance for my phone call to always be taken. It offered me the chance, you know, to always get a meeting.
Exactly.
It doesn't mean that anything always comes from those things, but I sort of feel like because of what Trading Spaces brought to my life, I'm always a little bit further on the path than somebody else. It doesn't guarantee anything, but it just offers you so much more ahead of the game, you know.
Exactly. So tell us about Homemade Simple. That, again, you tell us specifically how that developed through, I guess, the experience that you had in Trading Spaces. They knew that, you know, your hosting skills, that you really would be a talent there, right?
Well, sure. Well, I mean, some of that is networking. I knew the person who was sort of in charge of finding that host, and he'd been looking for a project for me. So it actually took almost 2 years for even that to come to fruition. He was at the Oprah Winfrey Network at the time, and now I think he's with Seacrest, actually. But, you know, back then he was over at OWN, and he was like, hey, you know, would you be interested in this? And I said, that sounds like it's right up my alley, you know, going into people's homes with experts and escorting them as they go through change in a learning process, you know, because that's what the show is. It's not a competition per se, and there's no budget or time frame in that way. And it dealt more with like a storyline of families who needed certain things for specific, you know, occasions or situations in their life or whatever. But it was still me going in with a team of experts who helped them achieve their goals. And I said, well, yeah, I'd love to do that. So then it was really just a matter of it happened happening. You know, I mean, I met with a couple of people. I didn't really audition for Home Made Simple. I just kind of got it.
Right.
I had to have a lot of meetings. I had to have a lot of, you know, that sort of thing. And everybody had to agree and be on board. Primarily Procter & Gamble, who is the, you know, they're the main, basically the only sponsor of the program. So it was really more up to them than it was up to
yourself.
And
I think that seeing the success of Trading Spaces, somebody has to jump on that and say, hey, we're going to have success. And were you excited about being an Emmy Award nominee? Was that exciting to have?
Incredibly excited. You know, all the awards are just, they're so interesting. You know, I just went through an award season with my husband, who is in Casa Valentina on Broadway. He plays Valentina.
Okay.
And, you know, they had four nominations go to the play, and it was very exciting. You know, they didn't win any of them. And, of course, we're sitting at home going, oh, come on, you know.
Yeah.
And, like, we know in our heart that, you know, the other plays, you know, well, ours is better. But you have to learn, like, you can't take any of that to heart. But they do mean so much. And it was so much fun to go. And, you know, Trading Spaces had been nominated before, and my name had been on the ticket. Had the show won an Emmy, I would have gotten to take home a statue. But I'd never been literally nominated, like me, as a host. So, you know, that was just very validating. It felt so good.
So what are the other latest projects for you, Paige? What are you currently promoting?
Well, the thing I'm most excited about is this new play. I've never got to originate a role before. I'm really excited about that. A little nervous, but a little excited. And it's just a two-hander play. So it's just me and another actor, John Cariani, who I know and I've seen his work. He's wonderful. He was nominated for a Tony, actually, for the most recent revival of Fiddler on the Roof that was on Broadway. He played the tailor. And he's done a lot of television work. You would recognize him if you see him. He's sort of the go-to science geek for every for every episodic, you know. I can't wait. I start rehearsal mid-July. And like I said, it's up in the Berkshires at Barrington Stage. So actually, Pittsburgh's not that far away if somebody wanted to have a little getaway and come to the Berkshires in August.
Awesome.
And see dancing lessons. It's a touching, beautiful play about an autistic man and a injured Broadway dancer and how they, through their own separate gifts, take each other through the journeys that they need to grow in their own, you know, their own path.
So how much research, Paige, were you doing in understanding autism from doing this role?
Oh, well, I haven't done a lot of research with autism, although we do have a niece with Asperger's, and I have known other people who have dealt with that. In terms of researching an injured Broadway dancer, this is not something that is unfamiliar to me. In fact, I'm injured right now. Very injured. I think the actual tear has begun to heal,
I'm
in PT, but I had an annular tear of my disc, the L4, L5 disc. So I felt pretty prepared going in. The words just kind of
Left
off the page for me.
But think about also, I mean, you're playing the injured Broadway dancer, but understanding the fact of autism and so much this is going to draw as well for people that live with autism as adults and seeing this.
It's a wonderful portrayal of how they think, how they feel, how they're, you know, how he's still a man, a real man. You know, his mind works differently, but his body doesn't. And it's,
Absolutely, and you'll have to keep checking that, and you'll see the autism community hopefully flock and promote this very well so it continues to do very well. Well, I understand, Paige, you got a lot going on, but I appreciate just getting you on the phone. And so where can we find information on you, Paige, learn more about you? And
PaigeDavis.com.
All right.
It couldn't be more easy. You can follow me at @RealPaigeDavis. I would love that. If people follow me at @RealPaigeDavis, they're my best friend. It'd be fantastic. But everything is on PaigeDavis.com.
All right, well,
everything's there. My Facebook page, my Twitter page, my Instagram page. Oh my gosh, the whole thing. All of it.
Everything. You're so busy with so many different projects. Best of luck this summer, and we'll definitely have you back on if you have some new news. So just tweet
Thank
me out
you.
And then you're welcome to come back. So good talking
Will
to you.
Will do. Thank you, Neil.
All right, take care, Paige. See you later.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, and Pinterest, Neil Haley. And what's really interesting is I call it the Total Celebrity Show as well, because this is an absolute honor to have this man on the program. And you talk about three-time All-Star, two-time World Series champion, 1980 All-Star MVP. Again, his son is Ken Griffey Jr., so I'm so excited to welcome the program, author of Big Red, Baseball, Fatherhood, My Life in the Big Red Machine, Ken Griffey Sr. Ken Griffey, how are you, man?
I'm doing fine, doing real well right now out in Arizona. Just got finished up with a mini camp for the Reds for the draft choices that we had this past June, so I'm enjoying myself.
Well, I'm sure you are, and always, I guess, around the game, you enjoy that for sure, right? Baseball is definitely
right.
Part of your life for sure.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely, Ken. So really wanted to break down. I mean, this book is just amazing. When you think about the history that you're going to be talking about, you talk about first your life with the Big Red Machine, which, again, I guess every Cincinnati Red, that those years were very memorable for them, weren't they? And for yourself.
Oh, yeah. You know, I was very young in terms of young in age. In terms, I was 25, my first full big year year in the big leagues, and we ended up winning the World Series that year. And then 76 was the same way, we repeated. And I just enjoyed being in Cincinnati those first 11 years of my career. I was drafted by him in 69, and then I was able to play for him, got to the big leagues, won two world championships with him. You know, it was just enjoyable for me.
And what did you think of playing in Cincinnati? Especially being with the Reds organization now, what a town to play baseball in, isn't it?
Oh, it was a baseball town at that time. I mean, that's all you talked about. The Bengals were struggling, and we were winning, so it was a big opportunity for a young guy to come in, break in that lineup, and be able to play every day in Cincinnati. So it was a great time for me.
One thing you did mention in your book is this, especially Game 6 of the 1975 World Series. Can you share a little bit of that recollection?
Well, the recollection, you know, I had a pretty good day. I think I was 2 for 5. I had two hits. I know that one was a double to tie the game up, or we went ahead in the game. And the biggest onslaught was the fact that you're sitting there watching Marty Carville come up to pitch hit, and he takes one of the weirdest swings you ever want to see a hitter take. And the very next swing, he takes a perfect swing and hits a 3-run homer to tie the game up. And then we go into the 12th inning, and that's that famous Carlton Fisk home run where he's waving the ball fast to stay fair, and it stayed. And they beat us in the 6th game. But, you know, we knew we had the 7th game to go, so we weren't planning on losing that 7th game.
And that's interesting to talk about, for sure, because probably a lot of people that are, you know, not really baseball historians would thought, based on what Carlton Fisk did, that the Reds lost and they really won. So, you know, that's one of the biggest memories in baseball history. And yet, really, you guys won it. So,
yeah, you know, the strangest thing is that I was looking at an article and one day I was reading that Boston Red Sox 1975 hat was being sold as a memorabilia item for the 75 World Series. And I said, well, you know, the funny part was that Boston didn't win, you know, and they weren't selling the Reds hats for the 75 World Series. They were selling the Boston Red Sox hats for the 75 World Series. Because, you know, that image left, that image of Carlton Fisk, him waving that home run, and they won the game on that pitch. A lot of people thought Boston won the World Series, which, you know, we knew we had to go Game 7, and that's when we beat them in Game 7.
What do you think made your team so special in 75 and 76? What would you say?
Well, what made it so special was that everyone knew exactly what they had to do. We played hard every night. We had a lot of fun. I think that was the most important, is that we played the game as a game. And we had a lot of fun doing it. If somebody made a mistake and it looked funny or something like that, a lot of guys laughed. We had some pranksters. Tony Perez kept everybody in the lineup. I mean, yeah. Tony was the guy that, you know, he was the, what we called the Reggie Jackson. He was the one that stirred the, that was a straw that stirred the drink. So, Doggy was the one that kept everybody up, live, ready to go every night and ready to play and had a lot of fun doing it.
Absolutely. And it's something that, you know, that's the memories and that's a team. And I really like this year in sports because I think it's the greatest years of teams in a long time. When you think about two sports for sure. And I bring up the NBA Finals and seeing a team in the Spurs. And I also look at the team atmosphere of the Seattle Seahawks. And just to say, finally, we're hopefully getting back to team play. And you guys were definitely a team. It wasn't just one superstar that made you guys. For sure.
No. And you know, a lot of credit, you know, people don't give our pitching staff any credit. But I think, you know, those guys kept us always in the game. They gave us an opportunity. We knew we had a damn good offense. We knew that good offense. And the difference was that our pitching staff, Jack Billingham, Don Gullett, Freddie Norman, Gary Nolan, I mean, they kept us always in the game where we had an opportunity to win in the seventh and eighth, ninth inning, which was amazing during that 162-game season. I mean, those guys were outstanding. We had Raleigh Eastwick as our bullpen stopper, as Pat Darcy, Clay Carroll, Will McEnany, Pedro Rabon. I mean, those guys don't get any credit, but they are the ones that really deserve a lot of credit because they kept us in games.
Absolutely. And that team atmosphere is what wins. And that's what wins championships in baseball. And that's why it's such a great sport, because you can't just have one superstar dominate everything. It won't happen,
no.
Especially because of pitching and different things. And that's what makes baseball special, where you can see runs like years of teams that really didn't have the talent compared to the other teams, but yet got on a roll, got the right pitching, and then there you have it, a world championship for sure. Would you say, Ken, again, after 75 and 76, what do you think, how hard was it to kind of, after repeating as champions, to keep getting back and playing hard every year in your career after that? Because you've already tasted the greatest thing in the world, which is winning a world championship.
Well, it wasn't too hard to get back to. The thing was, after we left, you know, they started dismantling the team. They first went with Tony Perez. They traded Tony. And like I said, Tony was kind of the guy that kept everything going. I mean, he kept everybody playing out on the field, and he made it enjoyable to be around such thing. When we lost him, he was kind of our attitude and our backbone of our ball club. And we lost him in a trade to Montreal, and then the next year we lost Pete. I mean, you know, it was tough, but you still got to go out there and try to win. I mean, we came back in 79 and won our division, but you know, we got beat by Pittsburgh the 79. They were a team concept, you know, because they always had that song, "We are a family."
Exactly.
We are a family.
Yeah.
You know, and they went the same route that we were earlier in the mid 70s, and they went to 79 and 80. They were that way, and they played as a family, but. That's the hardest thing you think about is that, you know, if we would have kept that team together another 3 or 4 years, we'd have probably won 5 or 6 World Series.
Why did the team break up? Is this the time when finally free agency came into being, or what was the reasoning for it breaking up?
Well, that was one of the reasons. And if you think about it, you know, I guess Mr. Hausman and Mr. Wagner were so far ahead of everybody, and they were thinking of how much it would cost to pay that team.
Yes.
To keep that team intact, you know, and we weren't making that much money, to be honest, compared to what it is now. But, you know, I guess they were thinking that way. And, you know, you had Tony Perez, and he was making probably a little more than about $200,000 or $300,000. Joe Morgan, Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, and then the younger guys, which was me, Foster, Concepcion, and Geronimo, were starting to make our names for ourselves. And they knew they would have to end up paying us. So I guess they thought that way, and they started dismantling the club. And like I said, when Pete left, you know, a lot of us knew that if Pete Rose left Cincinnati, a lot of us wouldn't be around very much longer. Because, I mean, Pete Rose was Cincinnati, or is still Cincinnati.
He truly is. You're right. And that's another thing that I would never cover and ask a question on, because again, it's a controversy thing, but playing with Pete Rose. I mean, I did not like Pete Rose for one reason. I'm a Pittsburgh Pirate fan. So, you know, especially when he was the Phillies, you ever say you're a fan of Pete Rose for that, especially with the rivalry of the Phillies and the Pirates back in the day, you'd never say with Pete, but he was such a hard worker. For sure.
Well, he was a hard worker. He was very intense. He had a lot of fun with the game. Now, don't get me wrong. Now, Pete enjoyed the game, to play it as a game, but he was very intense, and he wanted to win it at any cost. Didn't make any difference. And he was our catalyst. He was on base. Once he started a thing, it was contagious. In other words, he got a hit. I got a hit. Morgan got hit, then Foster, then the rest of us. You know, it just went like that. As soon as, especially late in the game, but Pete started off an inning and we got a hit, we knew we were going to start to get runs at that point. So it was very important that we watched Pete and kind of emulated him in terms of getting base hits and getting on base and doing the right thing to win games.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And another one I was a fan of was Johnny Bench. And because, again, another unbelievable. These are guys that really just hustled in so many ways.
Yeah.
And they really showed the work mentality of Cincinnati playing for them.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. I mean, JB was a little different. I mean, he had a cannon for an arm, excellent catcher, did everything right. But the biggest thing I enjoyed watching JB is that he could definitely hit. As a right-handed hitter, you know, and it didn't make any difference. And he hit the high fastball better than anybody ever seen hit a high fastball. I mean, you couldn't blow a high fastball by him. I'm talking about J.R. Richards, Tom Seaver,
those guys.
You know, and J.B. would hit that high fastball, and he'd drive it to right field or left field or center field, I mean, consistently. And just to watch him play, like I said, the intensity of that ball club alone, our ball club, we played it like a business. It was our business. We played it hard every night. We didn't make any mental mistakes. And I think that's what Sparky enjoyed the most about it, was that we didn't make any mental mistakes when we went out to play. And we didn't make very many physical mistakes in terms of errors of that nature either. So we just, on the combination of all the things we had, speed, power, hit, what average, we're able to do things, move runners, and we can manufacture runs if we have to. So all those things combined made it a heck of a good team.
Definitely, absolutely. And then we go with Joe Morgan, another interesting player. I mean, because every one of them was somebody that I don't forget, and I didn't live in Cincinnati. That's the great thing. They were a national. You could remember Joe Morgan. You can remember Joe when he played till when he was a commentator. Just absolutely just an interesting player as well, for sure.
Well, Joe at that time was pretty much a second manager, you know, behind Spark. He would just do stuff that you wouldn't believe he understood what was going on. I mean, out on the field, he was like three or four innings ahead of everybody, too.
Yeah. There
was a game going on. So he was like a second manager behind Sparky, and it made things a little different. You're looking at a little guy. I mean, Joe was only about 5'7", and he can drive the ball out of the ballpark like he's like 6'4", 6'5". Good fastball hitter. Heck of a glove. Turn the double plays between him and David Concepcion up the middle. I think our biggest bonus was those guys up the bench. Bench, Concepcion, Morgan, and Geronimo up the middle that made it a lot easier for the rest of us to play the game because, you know, the game is played up the middle. We had guys that can turn the double play. We had Geronimo can run balls down and had one of the better arms in the league at that time. So we had just the best combination of all the things combined to be a good ball club. That we were able to put it all together and do the things we did.
Being on that team, how much do the fans now, the Cincinnati Reds fans now, like when you think about the Pirates and We Are Family, because I again living in Pittsburgh, but how does the Cincinnati Reds community love those 2 years of World Championships? Like the stories you're hearing all the time and all that. Yeah.
Well, they honor us almost every year. That's a strain. You know, you're sitting at say we go to a banquet or an autograph signing in Cincinnati, and they call out what we call they start naming us the Great Eight.
Oh, yeah.
You know, And, you know, I mean, that's a heck of an honor to be on a team that they just call you the Great Eight, and everybody knows what team it is, the Big Red Machine, the 75 and 76. So, I mean, I get chill bumps when they say that, you know, when they talk about the Great Eight, and they talk about me and Morgan and Foster and Geronimo and Bench and Perez and
Exception. Exactly, yeah.
And Rose, you know, and we, last year, 2 years, I think, it was the first time they honored us in Cincinnati, and it was the first time since 1976 that all of us went to our positions out on the field in Great American Ballpark, and we had a standing ovation.
Well, you definitely, what an amazing team for sure. And then the surprise, which I am looking at talking points now, I never knew that you played with the Yankees and that you played under Billy Martin and you have Yogi Berra and then the great George Steinbrenner as your owner. So you have some stories about that as well in the book, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I have a few of them in there. You know, Billy Martin, I played, my first year, we had Bob Lemon and he only lasted 2 weeks. And I think we were like 7-7, and the Steinbrenner decided, you know, we weren't going very well. And he fired Bob Lemon. And I'm not sure, I think it was either Clyde King or Billy Martin came in the next. And that, like I said, I had, you know, in 4.5 years in New York, you just look at it, I had 9 managers.
Oh, my gosh.
it was a revolving door with managers and players at that time. So nothing was ever stable in New York those 4.5 years I was there.
Definitely nothing stable. And what did you learn by playing in New York? What would you say? What did you learn from playing in New York? Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, I enjoyed playing in New York because, you know, first of all, when I first got there, the maze I had to go through to get to the clubhouse in Yankee Stadium was terrifying. You know, you're down that little tunnel and you're trying to find your way through to the Yankee clubhouse, and you had to go all weave through this little tunnel. But once you got on the field, I mean, it's just amazing. You played on the field with Maris, Mantle, DiMaggio, Yogi Berra, you know, and you get out there and you try to do the best job you can do. And, you know, sometimes you get yourself beat up a little bit. I mean, my first couple of years, it took me a while to get used to being in New York because I came from such a conservative place in Cincinnati, and New York was just like crazy with, you know, Steinbrenner, if you made a mistake in the outfield and he would bury you in the newspaper, and, you know, the news commentators and stuff would do the same things. It's just, you know, if you do something wrong in New York, they had so much ammunition and they used to just try to bury you in New York. But if you were mentally stable or mentally strong about stuff up there in New York, you can handle it. And, you know, I had to earn my respect, which I understand, you know, and I was one of the ones that I beat him in the 70s. I was on the team that beat him in the 76 World Series. We swept him 4. And I was kind of hated for a while in New York because I was on that Reds team in 76, which we swept the Yankees 4 in the World Series. And it just took a little bit of time, and I wasn't planning on rushing my time. I knew I had a 6 or 7 year deal. I knew I was trying to try to be there at least that long. I was there 4.5 years, almost 5. And I enjoyed every minute of it because they were just as knowledgeable, and I knew for a fact that, you know, they knew about the game just as much as anybody else, same as Cincinnati. Those fans in Cincinnati and New York knew all about their players and what their players were into and everything else, and that's what they were about. You know, then they came to cheer you on, and if you made mistakes, they let you know. But if you did well, they let you know that too.
We're talking to Ken Griffey, senior author of Big Red Baseball, Fatherhood, My Life in the Big Red Machine. Really an interesting story, and I didn't know about the Yankees for sure. And I think that helped you a lot to mentor your son in a way because of going through what you went through in New York, especially when Ken Griffey Jr. was just considered just one of the greatest players that always that played. There always are critics out there, and I'm sure you offered advice and helped him, mentor him in ways to go deal with the media, especially being considered one of the biggest and superstars of his time when he was playing.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of things he had. I knew he was going to have to go through, and you got to go through them by yourself. But you know, I kind of clued him on certain things. You know, always be respectful to the press because they can always make you or break you. And, you know, if you're respectful to the press and you do what you're supposed to do and talk to them, even if you have a bad day and you sit there and you answer questions, they'll respect you more than you can ever imagine if you sit there and you answer the question and you don't put anything on anybody else and you take the brunt of it like you're supposed to as you look at it and you say, hey, I did this, I did that, and, you know, my responsibility. And they'll respect you for that. But don't shy away from them. Don't pretend you don't want to talk to them or anything, because they will, you know, eventually they can get you. And I kind of try to make him understand that a little bit. Sometimes he didn't get that way, but because he was so young, he was so shy, and he just didn't like talking. You know, it wasn't that he didn't want to deal with the press. He just did not like to talk.
Oh, wow.
And later on, he started to come out of it and made it a little different, a little easier for him, but he understood what I was talking about.
Did you always know he was going to be that good when you were when he was a kid? Did you have the feeling?
Well, the biggest thing was, you know, he used to get himself in little trouble at home. Now, he was living in Cincinnati because, you know, I was in New York and I'd get traded there, and he was still playing ball in Cincinnati. He didn't want to make too many trips. He didn't want to go in the summer because he wanted to play ball. So he got himself in trouble a little bit, and his mom sent him up to me. And, you know, I was sitting there telling me, I said, you do know right from wrong. We went through that whole synopsis of being right, being wrong, and everything, and being a parent. And I said, do you want to go hit? And he said, yeah. So I would take him down to the cages in Yankee Stadium, and I would teach him a lot about hitting. You know, I'd throw batting practice to him. I'd throw him fastballs and curveballs and changeups, you know, and he told me he wanted to be a major league player. And I said, this is why we're going to work it. And I worked it. So by the time he was 14 years old, I couldn't strike him out. So I knew I had something pretty special at that time.
You definitely did have something special. Ken Griffey Sr. giving us a story of Ken Griffey Jr. And when you saw his career and you look back, did you expect this? Did you think in a lot of ways that once he started playing, he was going to be that good?
When I started playing with him, you know, when I got to Seattle and I'm playing left field and I'm watching him play center field, that's when it really hit me. I said, wow, I didn't know he was that good, because some of the plays he was making in the outfield and then, you know, at the plate, he can almost predict what he was going to do and how he was going to go about it. And, you know, it was amazing to watch him do all those things. But I really didn't think I had that good of a player until I actually started playing with him in Seattle in 90 and 91.
He was one of my favorite players, especially when the Pirates stopped having a team. That's the kind of a joke in a way, because the Pirates, with the whole small market thing, Ken Griffey Jr. was just my favorite because he just was amazing player and really just he was exciting. And any time you could just say, I'll choose a player because I'm not going to think about Barry Bonds anymore, there was the guy, and that was definitely your son, Ken. So how difficult was it to write the book when you were asked to write this book, especially about the Big Red Machine and all these different things? I'm sure you were excited to do it, but did you ever undertake something as complex as writing about your story and stuff?
Well, yeah. I mean, there was a lot of things that, you know, it took me almost 10 years to really decide what I was going to do. I mean, after I retired and after playing with Junior, it was my, you know, first father and son ever playing in the big league. So I thought about that, and I thought about my time in New York, four and a half years there, and then early in my career when I played with the Big Red Machine. So it took me a while, you know, and, you know, finally I got with Pepe and sat down with him, and a guy named Tom Bast, you know, he was one of the people from Triumph Books, you know, sat down with me, and he said, we think you have something to talk about, you know, in a book. And it just took me a long time to really say how am I going to go about doing it, you know, and how am I going to do it the right way. I'm not out for bashing anybody or anything of that nature, just telling the stories that just happened to me in the book and what was my life and no one else's. And that's the way we went about doing it.
Well, most definitely, and I'm sure now finally seeing the finished product, you're so excited, especially to get and do book signings. And I understand you did one in Cincinnati, but you're going to do one in New York and then again in Cincinnati. So there are definitely fans of yours, not just in the Cincinnati area, and they remember your time in New York and again with your son and all this. The interest is definitely more than just Cincinnati for the concept, especially you're going to be going to New York and for the book signing as well.
Yeah, we're gonna be doing a couple in probably in New York and a couple back in Cincinnati. Hopefully, we'll get to Seattle and do one or two in Seattle before the year's out. So we'll see how all that works out.
And you like talking to the fans about the memories? Is it interesting when they come up and talk to you about ask you questions and stuff?
Yeah, if they ask me questions that are in the book, yeah, I talk to them all the time about it. You know, they want to know the whole thing of what went on, you know. So, yeah, I talk to them when I'm signing the book and all that, and they ask me a certain question. I don't mind answering them. I'll tell them what's going on.
And how's your son? Has your son gotten a chance to read the book and stuff? And what is his thoughts, especially?
No, he hasn't got a chance yet. I mean, I gave him a book. Matter of fact, I gave it to him last month, but he's been running. He's out here now. You know, his daughter's at the University of Arizona. She got a basketball scholarship, so he's been out here, and his son's already out here at the University of Arizona on a football scholarship. So he's been busy trying to get her out here, get her settled in and everything else for the last couple of weeks. So I told him, you get a chance, read it, you know. So I think his wife has read some of it, but she hasn't told me anything yet.
Well, I didn't know about that, so that's something else for our fans to know about what Ken Griffey's Jr., how he has his kids continue to be great athletes as well. That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, both. One has a basketball scholarship, Taryn. She'll be a freshman this year. And then Trey will be a junior, a sophomore, and he's going to be a wideout. He's starting this year, and he's 6'5". He's a big kid. So, you know, I watched him last year in the Advocate Bowl. He had two touchdowns in the Advocate Bowl, and they beat up Boston College pretty good. And that was his opportunity. You know, he did well, and now he's going to probably be starting this fall at the University of Arizona.
Oh, well, fantastic. It looks like Ken Griffey Jr. has learned from you on being a great father, especially yesterday being Father's Day, and is able to get his kids to excel in athletics as well. So, Ken, where can we purchase your book and also learn more about you?
Well, you can get it on Amazon.com, and I think it's Barnes & Noble. They have books in Barnes & Noble. There's a lot of them, and I know there's a few of them at Kroger's that they sell out of Kroger's book department and stuff. So those are the places, and you can get them online. I said at Amazon, you can get it online.
Well, fantastic. I really enjoyed talking with you, Ken. Do you have any? Are you on the social media end? Do you have a Facebook fan page or Twitter or anything?
Not yet. No, not yet. No, I'm working on it, though.
Honestly, I'm going to be honest with you, Ken. Twitter is just absolutely amazing how you can connect with so many people and how quickly you can become relevant again in this field, especially when you have a book to sell and also trying to tell your story. You wouldn't believe how powerful Twitter is, but good talking to you, Ken.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks again for calling.
All right,
take care. You're listening to the Author's Corner on the Total Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Total Tutor, and Pinterest, Neil Haley. And, oh, I'm so excited. Anytime when I go back to NBA players and fans of their game, and I remember him the days of North Carolina to the days with the Dallas Mavericks, when I think that was when the Mavs really started to become who they were as a team for sure. So I'm excited to welcome the program. 1985 NBA All-Rookie Team, NCAA Champion 1982, two-time All-American, gold medalist, and New York City Hall of Famer, Sam Perkins. Sam, thanks for calling.
I appreciate it, man.
I tell you, Sam, it, looking back to your entire career, I'm sure there's a lot of memories for sure.
Yeah, there are. I mean, I don't know where to start, but I think my whole college life was unforgettable, and all the memories from my freshman year to my senior year, they were all they were just all key and to everything I did at Carolina.
Absolutely. And it's something that, again, your career, I tell you, when I look at your career and look at your numbers and stuff, I said, you know what, you definitely got in the Hall of Fame in New York, but you definitely had a storied career for sure in the NBA, a lot of seasons for sure, and really played really well. But life after basketball, Sam, that's tough, isn't it? When you finally are ready to hang it up and say, hey, I got to move on to something else, it's difficult, isn't it?
Well, I mean, for, I guess the transition is kind of hard because you're faced with, like, you've been doing this. You realize your body and mentality has been doing this for so long. I played 17 years, and, you know, once it's over and once it stopped, it's like a lot of things stop, and your body just kind of like a subconscious, you know, block. All of a sudden, it just stops, freezes, and you just kind of like, what I'm going to do next. But some guys like myself prepared, you know, yourself and, you know, after basketball. And the thing is, you have to prepare while you're playing. And so I did a lot of things, interesting things that that I thought I might be interested in after my career was over, and that was communication. So I did a lot of those type of things with radio for the Pacers, being vice president of player development with the Indiana Pacers and Larry Bird, and just doing a lot more things that I probably wouldn't have thought about if I didn't prepare myself.
So you were prepared through college, you were prepared through life in basketball to be a student in the game, understand the game, not just your position, but the positions around you, and learn from great coaches that you played for sure.
Yeah, you kind of learn, well, you would like to learn, other than just play ball, you would like to learn the business side of basketball, which is called, and you want to be able to read contracts, talk to players, kind of, you know, mentor them in some sense to where they should be going or what they should be doing instead of resting all their laurels on just playing into basketball, because, like I said, once you stop, as your body goes into like a shock in a sense, and your mind does too, and you're going to say, what I'm going to do next? And by that time, it's almost a little late. So you want to learn all the ins and outs of basketball, the different levels, the GM position, president position, manager position, all those type of things if you want to pursue that. Some guys just get away from it and said, I'm done. But and they have other interests, which is fine. But if you like the NBA and you like what it's done for you, you might want to come back and want to mentor some of the players and try to address some of the issues that one may go through.
So, Sam, basically what you did was you kind of took extra time to learn more about the game than just the on the court. You learned from broadcasting. Did you do some parts of broadcasting during your career as well, like doing like a show? Did you have a Sam Perkins show or certain things like that on different teams to learn the media and understand it so you could take a role?
Yeah, I did. Once I got into L.A., which was probably where everything started, that was probably the middle of my career or the prime years, I started to attach myself with the radio stations out there. And you get involved with the community in that way. And notice the different charities. You get to know a lot of people who works in different organizations. And then at the same time, I got traded from there, and I took that to Seattle, where everything started, you know, right there for me, because I had a radio show with music, learning the radio, I guess, personality, all the intricacies of what radio and communication is all about. And I had a show there, a music show for the Sonics right there for at a station there. It was on every Sunday, and people would tune in and listen. So you give your opinions on the day's topics and what was going on, the day's music, and people tend to like that when they see or hear somewhat of a basketball player on the radio and given full knowledge of what they like and playing the music that they enjoy. But not only that, I just took time in the summers and went to different radio stations where I went to school in North Carolina and just learned how to look at a board and how to work the system so that, you know, it would, you know, if I went somewhere else, they wouldn't be as surprised, like, oh, you know, you don't know this and or you know that. But I fully try to understand and equip myself on all the things that communication is all about. It's in the front of the camera, and interviewed Mike Tyson after one of his fights.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, one of those type things in Vegas. Also, which what they called in the cans. You know, all these videos are in cans. So, in a sense, I've had some taping of that. Radio, like I said, TV, the Pacers. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed all of that. And it helped me to do, you know, communicate with a lot of people. And it got me talking more in front of crowds and being comfortable when I start talking to kids at different schools and different forums.
What's interesting, Sam, when you're talking about this is the fact that who would have thought when you're playing in the NBA, you had a radio show, you know? So you really had to take the responsibility, understand the right music's being played, that you're constantly going live in specific things. So it really helped, I guess, when you were with the Pacers to be able to commentate on things and stuff like that and say, hey, I need a third take. You didn't need to do that because you were used to doing live radio for sure.
Right, and, you know, I look back, and I was looking back, and I couldn't believe I was doing all this on a Sunday. The show's on Sunday nights, of course, and I couldn't believe I was doing this while I was playing.
That's amazing, yeah.
But it was something I enjoyed doing, and I did it without even thought. So when you go on live, you know, when the breaks are coming, you know what to say, you know, you got to cue up the music. Those things that make it more, you know, make it more of... No, more known or more like more applicable or competent of knowing what you're doing, and that's what I was doing, and I didn't want to falter, and so it was my first chance. I didn't want to blow it, and so as time went on, it just got easier for me. And once I got to the Pacers, you know, you can, you know, to analyze all the talent and everybody that's on the court, you know what to say and when to say it, and you know, there's people in your ear at the same time, you know. But also, you just know, you know, how the feeling of it. So I felt comfortable once I got there. So those are the things I did enjoy. And other things in traveling, drawing, and things of that nature, playing music, you know, physically with a guitar. I mean, all those things drew me in because of communications.
We're talking to Sam Perkins, former NBA player, involved with the NBA right now. But it looks like he learned so much about I guess the ins and outs of different things. So I think that your time, it was right before the money got really good. I'm sorry to say that, Sam, and I think that a lot of guys in your era say that,
right.
You know, compared to the, so that you kind of are like the kind of the Steelers. When I talked to certain super Steelers of the 80s and 70s, they had to go ahead and find that other job. So they had to look at life after. They had to look like, oh, am I going to be an analyst? I'm going to be this. But when you're talking about, you learn not just the game on the court, but you also learned the ins and outs of basketball operations. Who taught you that while you're still playing?
Well, it was the people that were that got in your phone. They always have the PR people, the public relations people, and they, you know, each team, I've been to four teams, luckily, fortunately, and those people are in charge of appearances and in charge of, you know, what you do off the court, how to say things, how to gather yourself in front of people, all those things just to mentor you so that when you go to people, you won't be so clumsy or incompetent or incomplete, as they say. But, you know, you listen to them, and each place I went, they all had a different – they had the same core mentality is to, you know, represent the NBA or your team, yourself well, but at the same time, learn different things. You want to go to this when something's going on outside of basketball, like a fundraiser or a reception or some type of community service, you wanted to go. You just didn't want to, you know, they think it should be best. They advised that you should go and open your you know, your mind up to other things. So that's what I did. And I started, you know, volunteering places where it was beneficial. Maybe even though I didn't, you know, wasn't looking for a reward, it helped me prolong my career in the NBA and off the court with different people. So once they saw you evolved or attached to a certain, you know, charity,
right,
that's become more often. So I started doing that, and it was it helped, you know, longevity wise. When even now, they know that I was part of Big Brothers or Big Sisters or Special Olympics or whatever the charity was or organization was. people are now familiar and they say, oh, you know, Sam Perkins or so-and-so was here last year. Maybe we can get him again. So I think for players now, like you said before the money got good, there's more opportunity now for players to do that post because everything was just coming off the cuff, in a sense. And players and football players, baseball players, are all now, you know, they say, well, maybe we can use an athlete instead of a personality from TV. And personalities started rolling in. And as players became different in their own way, we were being used in that sense. So some players took advantage of it. Some players didn't. But it was more of a conglomerate of people that were saying, like, well, maybe, you know, basketball players or football players are now, you know, ready to, you know, go on the other side. And so people were more comfortable with players doing that. And I felt comfortable for sure. And that's how you grow. And that's how players should grow instead of trying to just be one-way mentality of just playing ball, because there's so many opportunities out there for them. Whether they get paid or not, it's for your benefit and give you a personality at the same time.
We're talking NCAA 1982 champion for the North Carolina Tar Heels and Dallas Mavericks and many other NBA teams, from the Lakers to the Seattle Supersonics. Sam Perkins, and Sam is talking about life after basketball and preparation. So basically you talked about some charitable aspects of it when you were playing, being involved with Special Olympics. Tell us about that. And I know you still are involved with them.
Well, yeah, that's one of my, that's probably my favorite, because I was probably involved in it before I even really got attached to the organization. But long story short, it's like I had a friend when I was younger, and I didn't know he had special needs, because he looked like you and I, you know, but he was, you know, not disabled or anything. He just needed assistance. And at the same time, we worked together, and I didn't notice it, but he asked me a question I didn't think twice about, because we had a summer job, and he asked me to go to the bank with him. And I said, okay, to cash the check when we got paid. And I said, okay, no problem. What happened was, he was like, he was afraid that people would take his money. You know, back in Brooklyn, back in New York, yeah. You know, you had all kinds of people looking at you. So, you know, we had summer jobs, they would rob you. So I wasn't one of those guys who was afraid. So he said, come to the bank with me. I said, okay, no problem. Got into the bank, he wanted all one. And we cashed in like a $400 check, but right. He wanted it for once. Come find out, he can count that way. It was easier for him to count. So when I asked the teller, she looked at me like I was crazy. And I said, please, he just wants, you know, 401. So, I mean, didn't even think about it. Okay, years later, I'm at school, and I went away, he went away, I went to college, and I came back, and someone invited me to a Special Olympics thing in Connecticut, and they were having one of the festivals there. First person I see in a track meet was my friend who wanted $400. And so I was involved, you know, way before, but I could never beat him in track or running on the block of New York in Brooklyn, but I see now why, because that was his field. That was his feature. So I couldn't, he gave me head starts too. And so it goes to show you that I, you know, once I did all that and saw him again, I couldn't believe it. And he wasn't embarrassed. I wasn't embarrassed. It's just the fact that, you know, you never know what, you know, what recycles and what comes back at you. So I got involved with the Special Olympics right after that. And they asked me to be a part of it. And I've been a part of it now for, a board member, one of the board of directors for about now, going on 6 years. And it's been fun, because it's you represent people. It's not a charity, but you represent people who have been, you know, shunned from society in different countries. And I've been to different countries, and you see the good and the bad. But it's coming around where people are now open-minded to say that they have a special need person or child or relative. And it's prevalent throughout the Hollywood scene, basketball scene. I mean, people you just don't know, and you would be amazed that they wouldn't say nothing. But now people getting comfortable because we're trying to make awareness happen for everybody.
Well, that's fantastic, and you definitely can give us more information on the Special Olympics at the end. Currently, what are you doing? Are you? I heard you're working with the NBA. Do you have any other projects as well?
Yeah, I work with the NBA as a consultant, and we go over with special events in different parts of the country, such as Spain. We go to China. I've been to Manila to promote basketball because I think the Houston Rockets and Pacers, since I was formerly with the Pacers, you know, went over there to promote them when they came at the beginning of the year. So I also do camps, which I have one coming up now in Chapel Hill. I've been doing that forever. And the kids keep coming back. So as long as they come back, I got to keep coming back. It's one of those things where it's just all for the kids. And I don't think camps are prevalent as much anymore. I don't hear many about camps. But this one, we got all the Carolina guys from different years come back. So it makes it more fun and more widely, you know.